Even though this is second lecture that I'm giving, this is real introduction to seismology, and we'll consider some things that are, but really consider maybe not the proper word, is briefly review some things that are taught within the first two or three classes of any introduction to seismology course, just that the bases are covered. I'm quite sure why it doesn't come back to life. Let's see, well, let's try.
There's a cursor
blinking, so it's on, but for whatever reason it doesn't want to come on.
Oh, because maybe you have to. No.
That's resizing.
I hate to start it from scratch.
It's your computer.
It's my computer. It's my computer. Well,
restarting it will take.
It will take 2 or 3 minutes, probably. Let's see. Well, I guess I can restart it. I guess we're going to watch it in slow motion, especially when we'll be checking the disk. So the plan of the lecture is essentially to go through the elementary concepts such as stress tensor, strain, elasticity, and then the wave equation, and talk a little bit about the wave propagation in very simple media. Guy Masters will give a lecture on Friday, I think, where he will talk more about body waves and how they relate to the deep interior of the Earth. As I say, it's going to be a very slow process, I guess. So we want to cover within the next. Well, it's sort of getting there, I guess. But I will try to write some equations, but very few, just sort of fundamental things on this pad here, in order that we wouldn't have to bother with lowering and. And raising the screen. Now that it's too a little while.
Looks like you're filming an ad for Mac.
I know that the Macs actually start easier or faster.
You don't have to wait for standard.
Well, even if you kill the, well, things never get hung up. New hardware.
Cancel.
Cancel. All aboard. Still not quite there, but getting there. Well, maybe I'll get. There, I had it half an hour ago. So we'll talk about seismic waves and then two topics which, especially anisotropy, becomes an important tool in understanding some processes within the Earth's interior, particularly frozen directions of mantle motions or mantle shear. An attenuation which will not be covered in any other lecture. So the concept of stress, you apply tractions to three different size of a cube, and you have the traction component acting on a particular wall, and that results in, can be written in terms of the stress component. This is a classical figure which shows, essentially demonstrates that stress is in a tensor, and it is because it relates in general way to vectors. That is, in particular here we have that the force, or T in this case, is equal to sigma stress tensor times vector normal to the surface of this tetrahedron. So that's a stress tensor. The other things that one does with stress tensor is to, so these are six or nine components. The convention is such that the first index designs the which axis is particular wall perpendicular to, and then in which direction the force acts. One of the first things that is done is to demonstrate that the stress tensor is symmetric, that is that sigma ij is equal to sigma ji, and this is done by applying torques to a very small, usually in two dimensions at the time, and essentially by shrinking the volume of it, you show that the only way that the preservation of momentum law will be satisfied if indeed the differences between sigma ij minus sigma ji is equal to zero. So that proves this stress tensor is symmetric and it has only six independent components. Stress can be projected through rotation into the principal axis system. So here, for example, you have shear stresses applied to this square, but by rotation by 45 degrees, you can bring it to a principal coordinate system in which you're going to have only sigma 1-1 and sigma 2-2, which I guess will be opposite in value, so that the trace of the stress tensor, the third value, is equal to zero, and that sigma 1-1 is equal to minus sigma 2-2. Now the next point that has to be made is essentially to derive the momentum equation, and that equation states that d sigma ij by dxj is equal to rho square second derivative of u vector over dt square. So this ignores body forces such as gravitational force, and at high frequency that's very, very appropriate approximation. The only time in which the inclusion of body forces is important is at extremely long periods of free oscillations, where a significant amount of energy can be actually gravitational energy. So that's about stress tensor, and as I say, we have this equation here, motion. The strain or a deformation in general is obtained by both translation and deformation of a material. And essentially the stress deformation tensor is dui over dxj. Again, there are nine components of it. It can be represented in terms of a sum of a symmetric part and anti-symmetric part of it. And it's relatively easy to show that the anti-symmetric part of the deformation tensor actually corresponds to rigid rotation, so it's not of particular interest. But actually deformation is the strain tensor epsilon ij is equal to 1/2 duj by dxi plus dui over dxj. So obviously the strain tensor is also a symmetric tensor. The example of the different deformations that can be applied is, for example, if you deform body in one direction, you introduce both change in volume and change in shape, because the proportions of this rectangle change. So, since it's a two-dimensional case, it changes in area. On the other hand, if you apply shear to the same square or rectangle, you obtain this type of a deformation, but exactly half of it is rigid rotation. So you have to rotate it back a little bit, and in this case, you get actually the deformation of shape that you want. So that's the strain tensor. The stress and strain are related to each other by, as Lars mentioned, so the sigma ij is equal to cij kl times epsilon kl. Okay, so there are two second rank tensors related by a fourth rank tensor, which in theory would have 81 components. However, there are all kinds of symmetry conditions, partly resulting from the fact that both stress and strain are symmetric tensor, and then because potential energy has to be continuous, so the symmetry conditions are such that Cij kl is equal to Cji kl, and it's equal to Cij lk. And what's really important is that you can substitute this group of indices, that is equal to C LK IJ is also equal to this. So this actually reduces the number of independent components of the elasticity tensor down to 21. The engineering way of writing this is in terms of vectors of length 6, so that sigma 1, 1, sigma 2, 2, sigma 3, 3, sigma 2, 3, sigma 1, 3, and sigma 1, 2 is equal to the two-dimensional C11, C12, and so forth, C16, this is C22, C66 times, and this a little bit different, epsilon 11, epsilon 22, epsilon 33, epsilon 2 times epsilon 32, 2 times epsilon, sigma. I'm sorry, epsilon. 3-1 and 2 times epsilon 2-1. Or 1-2, doesn't matter. So this matrix here is symmetric, and as I say, it's 6 by 6, but it's a symmetric one, so there's 21 independent components, and that's a most that one can have. However, different materials have different symmetry conditions, and we are talking both about plane of symmetry and axis of symmetry. And the plane of symmetry is when the essentially the mirror image of the body does not introduce any change. And so this will be plane of symmetry, and axis of symmetry is if rotation about the given axis does not, or well, sometimes it's the level of axial symmetry is numbered. For example, you can have 90 degree rotations, or you have a rotation about any angle about the symmetry axis. So if all axes are axes of symmetry and all planes are planes of symmetry, then we are dealing with isotropic medium. And in this case, sigma ij is equal to lambda epsilon kk times delta ij plus 2 mu epsilon ij. This is Kronecker's delta, so this would be 1 only for diagonal elements. This implies summation, so this is a trace of the strain tensor or a relative change in volume. What we can do now is to plug this expression into our equation of motion, and I don't want to do all the algebra. I think that it's trying to die on me again. And you essentially, well, okay, so this is for isotropic medium. Then there are different levels of anisotropy, and one that perhaps is used most is the so-called transverse isotropy or radial anisotropy. It's confusing because these are opposite terms, but essentially in this case, out of 21 components, possible components of the elasticity tensor, only 5 of them are different. And if you are, if your axis of symmetry is vertical, then you have the individual elastic constants are proportional to density times p velocity in a horizontal direction, in horizontal plane, p velocity along the vertical axis, and so forth. The same is true for SH and SV waves. And this is a off-diagonal term, which normally would be equal to the Lamé parameter lambda. Yes?
When you're talking about PH and PV, and P is compression rate, right?
Yes.
So we're just talking about direction and space. I thought S can be, S has two perpendicular components.
Yes, we'll talk about this. There's a little bit of confusion in terms of the SH and SV velocity, for example, or PH and PV. This is vertical, say Z, and this is X. And essentially, if you have P velocity or wave propagating in this direction, it will propagate with VPV velocity. And if it propagates in this direction, it will propagate with VPH velocity. So for example, if you have a ray, curved ray path in the Earth, something like this, and let's say this is a P wave, it will be pure VPH only at the bottom, because at this point the propagation is purely horizontal. Here, for example, it would be some mixture, and there are formulae for this to evaluate the effective velocity in a particular direction. Now, the tricky thing is that, so coming back to the, and we'll just consider at this point the isotropic case. We have that you can show by using so-called Helmholtz substitution that you introduce a scalar potential phi and a vector rotational potential xi, and that you can break up the equation of motion obtained by substitution of sigma in terms of the strains into this equation, and it will separate it into two equations. One where you have that del square phi is equal to 1 over alpha square d square phi by dt square. And the other equation will be del square psi is equal to 1 over beta square d psi by second derivative with respect to time. Yes?
I have a question about just the number of independent
elastic
constants.
Uh-huh.
For isotropic, there are two independent
constants. Yes.
But how about for the translation charge? I mean, are those independent?
These five are independent. So you essentially have one, you have three planes of symmetry, but only one complete axis of symmetry. So therefore, everything in a horizontal plane is isotropic. That's why it's called transverse isotropy. But the vertical direction along the axis of symmetry is different.
So I guess my question might be historical. Why is that chosen as kind of the standard for isotropic case rather than a simpler case where there would be three independent elastic?
Well, this particular one, and I don't know, Guy may know the full answer. The nice thing about this type of anisotropy is that the variables nicely separate, and you can actually obtain numerically exact solution to the problem.
The most general symmetry that you can have, and still have symmetry around the center of the Earth, and then all your variations will separate. If you go anything more than this,
right, okay. So this is basically the most general case we can still deal with.
Yeah. Well, there exists, I mean, there sort of exists relatively simple differential equations, and you don't have to, you can change variables in such a way that you never have to differentiate with respect to elastic constants, which is an unpleasant thing to do.
Mu is shear
modulus. Lambda is another Lamé constant, but actually, so mu of course, is non-zero only for solids. Lambda is non-zero for both solids and liquids. But Lars was talking about Bok modulus, and it's equal to lambda plus two-thirds mu. And that obviously has a physical meaning. It's the incompressibility modulus. Okay, so this essentially tells you what pressure you have to exert in order to obtain certain amount of volumetric deformation. Okay, mu tells you how much shear deformation you can introduce. Of course, in a perfect liquid, you cannot introduce shear, so therefore mu is zero for liquids. The other useful values are Poisson ratio. It's different sigma. There's only so many Greek letters, I guess. Somebody complained about gamma being used too much, but sigmas are used a lot too, because they're usually electrical conductivity, they are stress, and in this particular case, it's Poisson ratio, which is equal to 1/2 of lambda over lambda plus mu. And for geological materials, particularly materials of the Earth's crust, actually lambda and mu tend to be equal, in which case Poisson ratio is 0.25, and very often this solid that has these properties is called Poisson solid, and it greatly simplifies. Now, these velocities, for example, alpha is the velocity of compression waves, and it's equal to square root of lambda plus 2 mu, or divided by rho. Beta is shear velocity, is equal to square root of mu over rho. So for Poisson solid, the alpha is square root of 3 times larger than beta. And because in practice, shear velocity, especially in sort of crustal experiments, is more difficult to obtain, very often there's this scaling is used that if you have a compressional velocity, you just multiply or divide it by square root of 3 and you obtain shear velocity. Now, these two equations, and we now introducing a concept of a plane wave. This is a sort of standard picture of the shear waves. And P waves, even though they are called compressional waves, you can see that anytime you can see the change in shape, you actually have certain amount of shear. So the size of these blocks, which were initially equal, they become rectangular with longer axis in a vertical direction or longer in horizontal direction. So both you have a change in volume and change in shear. So actually, compressional waves for Poisson solid are about four-ninths of their energy is in shear. Okay, on the other hand, the S waves are pure shear energy. Now, if you are far away from your source, you have a source, say an explosion, and you have a spherical wavefront. If you are far enough or many wavelengths away from the source, you can make this plane wave approximation where essentially draw a plane that is tangential to the spherical surface. And then you are talking about the wave propagating in that direction along that plane. You select your coordinate system such that that plane is, this is x1, x3, and x2, that the plane is perpendicular to the parallel to the x2 axis. Okay, so that actually nothing will change with respect to axis x2. This allows you to separate these equations into a set of three equations. That U1 for the displacement in a U1 direction, it's equal to d phi over dx1 plus d psi 2 over dx3. U2 is simply d psi over the, well, x1 plus d psi over dx3. U3 is equal to d phi by dx3 minus d psi 2 over dx1. So you can see that U1 and U3 are coupled, that both potential, both the scalar function and the second component or two components of the rotational function are concerned. And this, so therefore, U1.
What component of psi is in the second equation?
It's also a scalar function, essentially. It doesn't matter, I guess, which one.
It's not the same psi as a psi.
No, it's different psi. So the U1 and U3 are coupled, and they involve both P and S motion. And this code is called PSV case. On the other hand, U2 component is independent of that. It's clearly a shear wave, but it's in U2 direction, and in this way you have decoupling of the PSV and VSH. And for example, if this is the direction of propagation, you have a P wave that propagates, and the particle motion is in this direction along the line. SV is perpendicular to it, and SH is in the direction perpendicular to the board or screen. Okay, and the SH and SV are actually decoupled. And this is where the velocity for SH and SV waves come into play, that you can actually have SV and SH propagate waves, propagate with different velocities. Okay, there is a. It can be shown, I guess. Meaning, it's not not. Yeah. It's not that it's particularly difficult, but it takes a little bit of algebra. Actually, what I forgot to say is that this part of the lecture is based mostly on chapters 2 and 3 from this introduction to seismology, and it sort of covers about 200 pages here. But what you do is you essentially say. Yeah. So U is the displacement vector. Okay, and it has three components. We can actually say the Helmholtz substitution is that U vector is equal to the gradient of the scalar potential phi minus curl of the vector potential function psi. The additional assumption is that divergence of psi is equal to zero. We are representing one vector function by two functions, so we have certain degrees of freedom. So we can assume that the divergence of psi is equal to zero. And then if you sort of go and substitute the identities for curl of psi, you essentially can reduce it to this system of equations, or essentially show that the equations separate. Okay, that you have this couple of things and this one is separate.
So that psi is totally different from that is some
kind. It's some other psi, and basically, because it's only function of one function rather than two, you essentially proceed immediately with equation for U2, satisfying essentially equation for shear wave. So you actually don't have to bother with psi. So U2 is simply something that is independent of U1 and U3. And notice there are no derivatives with respect to X2, because nothing, the way we oriented our plane wavefront is such that nothing varies with X2. So all the derivatives with respect to X2 are zero. This is actually a seismogram, and seismograms are recorded on three components. One is vertical, one is oriented east-west, and the other one is oriented north-south. Doesn't matter, it doesn't have to be north-south and east-west, as long as they're orthogonal, more or less, and you know the direction. Then you can rotate them into the radial and transverse component, essentially the two horizontal components, so that the radial component is essentially in a direction of propagation of the wave, and the transverse component is perpendicular to it. And so you can see here, for example, that there are some phases that come before after on a transverse component, after some waves already arrived on the radial component. And in particular, we'll look at the SKS and SDIF, which is diffracted S, particle motion. And in this case, the S and SKKS, these are waves, shear waves that go and travel through the core as a compression wave, then convert back to S. And as you can see, the very little motion on the transverse component, pretty much all the motion on the radial component. On the other hand, if you look at the S diffracted, most of the motion is on the transverse component and very little on the radial component. So this would be SH diffracted. This is SKS because of the conversion into P wave. You are guaranteed that the S motion should be the SV motion. Okay, there's, except for some conversion of discontinuities, you should not have any SH in it. The medium can be, depending on the scale in which we want to deal, can be represented either in spherical coordinates when you talk about the whole Earth. It can be radially symmetric, that is, properties are only function of radius, or it can be in three dimensions, that is, the velocity is function of radius, co-latitude and longitude. You can have stratified half space where the velocity, for example, is function of z, continuous function, or you can have a layered medium where you have discrete changes in velocity. If you have enough of these layers, you basically can represent the continuously varying media. However, at the boundaries between layers, certain conditions have to be satisfied. And for PSV waves, that is, ones that propagate in a vertical plane, you have to have that U1 is equal to U1 prime, where prime would be the second layer. This is a prime layer, and it's characterized by alpha 1, beta 1, and rho, which is density 1, alpha 2, beta 2, and rho 2. So you have a continuity of the horizontal motion, continuity of the vertical motion, continuity of the radial stress. And continuity of the tangential stress. So you have four boundary conditions, and in order to satisfy them, an incident P wave, things get tricky once you get beyond the critical angles, converts into four different waves. So for example, incident P wave will have a reflected P, but also parts of its energy will convert into SV, and part will be transmitted as P, as you can see a little bit refracted, and part of it will be transferred into converted SV. And the same is true with respect to SV waves, again, four rays coming, one ray coming in, four rays coming out, but you have four boundary conditions which allows you to solve the problem for so-called reflection transmission coefficients, and we are not going to get into this. It's quite important in designing seismic experiments, essentially at all discontinuities, in particular discontinuities such as MOHO, the upper Mantoux discontinuities, there are certain conversion of energy and there are certain reflections from these discontinuities of which we take quite a bit of advantage of in terms of learning about the Earth.
Is there a pure compressional wave?
Well, but P waves, no, it's very difficult, well, except for if you are in a uniform medium and you have explosive source, then presumably you would have only compressional wave. Okay, for example, earthquakes generate a very good sources for shear waves. They also generate some P waves. But if your wave travels through many discontinuities, you essentially will generate also from, even from explosion, you generate some shear energy. So you have some shear wave arrivals. So the pure P wave, I mean, it's essentially the first arrival is pure P wave because that's the fastest wave that propagates. But after that, there is additional energy which will involve some converted waves. Okay, so this is why when we looked at the seismogram, this is why they look so complicated. Here you have a P diffracted, which the distance is 110 degrees, so you don't have a direct P, but P propagates along the Kormantu boundary. But then you have all kinds of other things, very complicated phases. In this case, for example, this is S wave, which then traveled into the core, was once reflected in the core, and then comes out as a P wave. Guy who will talk in some detail about it on Friday. But now, this is an example of a reflection coefficients. Now, this is at free surface. At the free surface, the conditions are different. Stresses at the free surface must vanish, and that gives you two boundary conditions for at the surface. Okay, for PSV. For SH, you have only U2, which must be continuous at any boundary, and sigma 2-3 must be equal to sigma 2-3 prime. So, because there are only S waves, two boundary conditions are sufficient. In case of the surface reflection, it's simply pure reflection for the SH waves at the surface. But as you can see, for PSV, reflected P, so the coefficient varies from minus one for vertical reflection. Incidence angle is measured with respect to vertical to essentially zero at something like 70 degrees. The converted reflected SV wave, again, varies as a function. There is no converted P wave into S at the normal incidence, the vertical incidence, but then it actually can get quite large, about half of the amplitude of the P wave. So this is important for understanding what it is that we see actually on seismogram.
But in the previous slide, what's the meaning of negative energy ratio?
It's an energy ratio between P and S waves, essentially. I don't know, I must say. It's positive for, I'm not quite sure what the energy, negative energy ratio would be.
It's a coefficient. For the energy, you have to square or
just. Yeah, well, the energy should be positive always, I guess, or non-negative. So maybe this is simply a weight of. The thick lines, yeah, so the thick line, let's see, energy ratio. Okay, so this is okay, because both energy ratio lines are positive. Okay, so you have the different ratio of P and S energy. So when the reflection coefficient, for example, for the P wave actually goes to zero, then you have everything, all the energy is in shear. Okay? So this sort of two parts to this. Maybe it's a little confusing. But all the reflection coefficients actually are negative, which means that imply change of phase. On the other hand, all the energies are positive or non-negative anyway. So these calculations can be easily done, and they help in understanding for example, they can be used to measure sometimes the jump in elastic properties and density across a discontinuity, which cannot be measured in some other way.
What is the difference between that stress continuous at the boundary or traction continuous?
Attraction and it's the same thing. Yeah.
In shear reciprocal, like introduction to seismology, you say like shear stress continuity is not right.
And a welded, yeah.
It's a welded boundary.
The attraction vector is one that's continuous, which is the stress tensor guided in the normal to the and the welded boundary.
Yeah. But it's basically the same thing. These are now the simplest seismic experiment is that of a layer over half space. They have two different velocities, V0 and V1. In this case, you are going to get there will be some waves that will enter the second medium and never come back, so you'll never see them again. But there are some which will fall on this interface at the critical angle, at which point they will propagate as a head wave along the surface of the boundary and then come back. And so that this wave, this so-called refracted wave, propagates for at least part of its path with the velocity V1. You also have reflected waves from the boundary. So the travel time diagram looks something like this. This is the reflected wave, it's a hyperbola. And then you have two straight waves, one that goes through the zero coordinate system. This is the so-called direct wave, propagates with velocity V0, and then you have the head wave which begins at not at a zero distance, but at some point, and it has a slope of 1 over v1. And essentially, by performing experiment like this, this is how Mohorovicic in year 1909 determined the crustal thickness and the velocity of the seismic waves in the crust and at the top of the lower upper mantle. As the number of layers increases, the picture gets more complicated, and actually, if you make many, many layers like this, you obtain something that will look pretty much like continuous function with the decreasing slope. And the slope here is called also slowness. So the higher velocity, the lower is the slope. And you essentially have a can have a continuous velocity time as a function of distance. And then there are some ways in which you, under certain circumstances, can obtain or retrieve velocity profile from it. An example of seismic refraction. Now, this is fairly large distance. There were some big charges fired up. It's a 700 kilometers long profile. Here you see what is actually crustal, the direct wave with velocity of more or less 6 kilometers per second. These are so-called reduced travel times. You subtract from the observed time distance divided by 6 kilometers per second, which is typical crustal velocity. But then you can see that there is a faster wave arriving, and that is called PN. And that has a velocity of approximately 8 kilometers per second. The next map is the map of the United States, both in terms of the crustal thickness here in kilometers. It's the thickest under the Rocky Mountains, where it's about 50 kilometers thick. It's actually thinnest in a basin and range when it's only 30 kilometers or so thick. There's also a map of PN velocities, and they range from 8.2 kilometers per second to about 7.7. Again, in this place where the crust is the thinnest, it's also lowest PN velocities, and the reason for it is that it's a very tectonically active region. It's a crust is stretched and therefore it's thinned. Temperatures are relatively high, which lead to the decrease in seismic velocities. On the global scale, the crustal thickness varies quite a lot. Crust is relatively thin. If you count water, the bottom of the crust in the oceans is about 10 kilometers. As you can see, under Andes and Himalayas, it can reach 70 kilometers. So continental crust generally is very different from oceanic crust. Typical crustal thickness is 40 kilometers for the continents, and well, the crust itself about 7 kilometers plus 3 or 4 kilometers of water for the oceans. Now, I'm not going to get into great detail here. It's just that for some things that I will be saying next, I need, for example, here, shear waves are plotted with a long dashed line. So you have an S wave, which converts itself in a core into P wave, then it's reflected from the core mantle boundary on the underside, travels further as a P wave, then converts itself into S wave, and this is called SKKS. The SKS is also radiated and comes here, and notice that because it has to convert, even if source radiated some SH, this would be completely reflected at the core mantle boundary, and only SV will be converted in P, and then comes on the other side. So the SK waves are favored in a sense that they are more or less guaranteed, or should have theoretically, purely SV motion. Now, this is a crystal of the olivine, the most common material of the mantle, and it has this property that the velocities or wave speeds in different directions are significantly different. So the highest velocity here is nearly 10 kilometers, like 9.89. On the other hand, along the slowest axis is 7.72. So it's nearly 25% difference between fast and slow direction. Okay, this is intermediate direction. Now, the olivine has a property that if under shear, it tends to align the fast axis in a direction of shear. And this is why we are wondering about or talking a lot about anisotropy, because we expect that the axis might be aligned in a direction of shear. If you look at another common mantle material, orthopyroxene, you actually see that the axis that tends to align itself with shear is the intermediate axis. So you don't particularly expect the anisotropy, the azimuthal anisotropy, that is something that would depend on the direction of propagation, to be associated with orthopyroxene, but you do expect it to be associated with olivine. So this is a picture which shows spreading lithosphere at mid-ocean ridge, and here are the compressional velocities recorded in different directions. This is on the ocean floor as a function of azimuth. And you can see that there is clearly this 2 times azimuth function. It's double 2 sinusoids. So it has 180 degree symmetry. And the difference here is from plus 0.3 kilometer per second to minus 0.3, or roughly 4%, plus minus 4%. It's plus minus 0.2%. So this is clearly not as much as the olivine itself, but obviously the mantle is not pure olivine, and also the alignment of the axis need not be perfect. But there is clearly fast direction here, which corresponds to the direction of spreading, and the slow direction. Now, it's possible also to perform similar experiments with surface waves. We'll talk about surface waves, I guess, on Saturday. But this, in color contours, are shown isotropic velocity perturbations. This is Rayleigh waves at 75 seconds. And then you have a direction of the fast axis, that is direction in which phase velocity or waves propagate, surface waves propagate faster. As you can see here, they are more or less perpendicular to the boundary, and the lengths of these lines are, this would be about 2%, so it's about 1.5%. So the variation is plus minus about 0.5%, 1.5%. You can see that actually with age, anisotropy decreases in the old ocean, and the reasons for it are complicated, but it's also the same region where a strong radioanisotropy develops, and it may have something to do with a destruction or erasure of the earlier anisotropy. Now, another important experiment in which one measures the anisotropy as well as its direction. So you have an S wave propagating an isotropic medium, then it enters anisotropic medium, at which point you can decompose the shear wave in two directions. Let's say that you know at this point which is fast direction, which is slow direction. So at first they are together, but as time elapses, they become separated. and then they remain separated once they exit from this medium, because this is isotropic medium, so it's not going to affect the polarization and the speed of the waves or the times at which they arrive. So this is so-called shear wave splitting. The shear wave through travel in an anisotropic medium has been split essentially into two waves, and this is observed, and you essentially try to resolve the fast direction and the slow direction, and this is where you can separate these waves in these two orthogonal directions, which are at some angle phi with respect to the azimuth in which the wave propagate. You can find the fast direction as well as slow direction. The example of it is shown in the next picture, where you essentially have the SKS wave recorded both on radio and transverse component. Now, you can rotate them by parameter search, where you find out where do you get maximum alignment between the first and second. So you have to delay it, in this case, by about 2 seconds, and you have to rotate it about 45 degrees. This is the maximum of this correlation function. So after it's rotated, you can see actually, you can see that the bottom wave arrives a couple of seconds later than the one at the top. And then you can rotate things and correct the SKS. And in this case, if you have done a good job, you should have nothing on the transverse component. So this is using the SKS waves to determine splitting and the direction of fast axis. And this is important. It's a subject to a lot of perhaps overinterpretation, but in theory, you could detect the direction of motion or director of shear in the past that had been frozen into the material. So it's actually used a lot, both in terms of the continental studies. For example, you might be able to obtain this way the absolute direction of the vector in which the lithosphere is dragged over the asthenosphere. And indeed, in North America, they seem to align themselves with the direction of the absolute plate motion. You can also look at subduction zones, and so this is used a lot. As I say, its interpretation is not very unique. The measurements, usually you see the best case possible, but there have been major controversies about this. But it is increasingly frequently used tool. Okay, so this is about anisotropy. We, at best, we look mostly for azimuthal and radio anisotropy, but it's possible also to look at things at, in more general way, although it becomes increasingly difficult to resolve it. Now what we are going to talk about is attenuation. This is an example of two seismograms, both from earthquakes, one in Basin and Range province, and the other one essentially in a old platform in a Mississippi embayment and recorded at a station in St. Louis, Missouri. So as you can see, there's very large difference in the frequency content between these two seismograms, and this essentially has to do with the fact that the attenuation in a cold, very competent lithosphere is much less or much less rapid than in case of the hot lithosphere in the Basin and Range province. Q and by the way, we have some really experts, top world experts here, much better than I on the subject. Both Barbara and Guy have written some classical papers on the subject. The important thing about Q is that Q changes exponentially as a function of temperature, where the velocity perturbations change only linearly. So particularly near the melting point, you can get extremely large variations in Q, and maybe easier to pick things up than just by measuring the velocity variations. I think the next slide is an example of the both the velocity and attenuation tomography under East Pacific rise. And you can see that this is variation here in Q by a factor of 5 in case of this extremely low, which probably is a magma chamber here under East Pacific rise, while the velocities change only by 10 or 20% at the same time. So this Q tomography does indeed show this is more compact region than this one, and is very useful in mapping cases, which in which case clearly here is the thermal source of this anomaly. Now, the one of the most spectacular results of the first of the lunar landings was the seismographs have been put on the moon. And notice the time scale. So this is a seismogram, quite compact, this is time is in minutes here, recorded at Cathedral Caves in Missouri. And this is a moonquake. And you can see there are sort of two things. One is that there is enormous amount of scattering on the moon. The other thing is that the energy just doesn't want to die. So there's very little, if any, water in the rocks on the moon. And this is sort of one of the indications that the presence of water inside the rocks is a one very important factor in increasing the attenuation of seismic waves. So in addition, of course, the medium must be extremely scattered in order to be able to bounce around all these waves. So that was one of the somewhat frustrating things, because you cannot really see much beyond the first arrival. It doesn't look like the terrestrial seismograms where you have all these other phases coming in. Now, in general, the attenuation at some given frequency can be presented as the decaying cosinusoid. So you have some zero amplitude, and then things, the amplitude of the envelope changes exponentially with time, where Q is in denominator. So this, the larger is the Q, the slower will be this decrease. Okay, and one way to measure attenuation is to measure, for example, rate at which free oscillations of the Earth decrease, or surface waves, or anything, any other wave. You can, if you take a Fourier transform of infinite decaying cosinusoid, depending on Q, you're going to get different spectrum. So if Q is high, actually 100 is not that high a Q, thousands is high Q. But it's compared here with Q of 15 and Q of 5. You can see that there is a trade-off between the height of the peak and the width of the peak. And actually one way to measure attenuation is the frequency difference at the point where the amplitude drops by half. And you can see that here it would be very large, here it would be very small. There's also a phase change as you go across in the spectrum, that's can help in locating essentially the central frequency, but is not particularly important, but that's another way of measuring Q is by looking at the width of the spectral peak, or there, if you have a series of sort of moving window analysis, a rate at which this peak will decrease with time. The simple mechanism for attenuation is the standard linear solid, which here is represented as having a spring, which represents the elastic behavior, and a dashpot, which is a shock absorber on your car and shows anelastic behavior. At the natural frequency of the system, you have the maximum damping. This is Q to the minus 1, which means that the 1 over Q is relatively large, and it decays more or less like 1 over omega on both ends. The important consequence of this is that the in order to preserve causality of the arrivals, there must be a dispersion of velocity with which waves travel through such medium. So the velocity, or for that matter, the modulus, either bulk or shear, are lower at zero frequency, and they are higher at infinite frequency. So one is called relaxed modulus, the other one is unrelaxed modulus. And this difference can be, there's no scale here, but it can be of several percent between the two sides. This is one reason why measurements in laboratories, which are sometimes made at very high frequencies, are not really representative of the seismic propagation, where instead of megahertz, you are measuring things at somewhere from 1 hertz to 1,000 seconds period. So this is a single absorption peak, but there are many reasons why there could be attenuation inside the Earth. So the different sources of attenuation are listed here, and combined, essentially, they can lead to sort of composite absorption spectrum, which actually can have constant Q over fairly wide range of frequencies. And this is to some extent observed in seismology. That's from periods of several hundred seconds and perhaps even 1,000 seconds to about 10 seconds, it seems like there is very little variation of Q with frequency. However, and this is now pretty old result, and not much that I know has been done since. This is from a paper by Sipkin Jordan around 1980, where they showed that somewhere around 10-second period, or 0.1 hertz in frequency, there appears to be a change, so that we are somehow at the frequencies higher than 1 hertz, we are actually somehow on the shoulder of the absorption band. So it's true that short period Q of P waves is quite different than the Q at very low frequencies. So it's actually can be that we see at least some complexity in the values of Q at long periods. At the same time, going down to 1,000 seconds, between 1,000 and 10 seconds, there seems to be very little variation in Q. Now, how does Q look like inside the Earth? There are several models. This is just the upper mantle. Some of them are quite similar and some a little bit different. But basically, you have a fairly high Q in the lithosphere. Krem had it much too high, but it varies probably in the high velocity lid to about 200, perhaps may go up to 300 in the crust. But then it drops somewhere in the distance, depth range from 80 to 200 kilometers. It drops to 80 or less, which is relatively low Q, and then it doubles for the rest of the upper mantle. It's difficult to resolve any variations in this depth range. And then in the lower mantle, it goes up to a little over 300. So this is a type of model which actually should be important in terms of understanding the thermal properties of the material in the upper mantle. The last thing I wanted to do, and I guess I still have a few minutes, is to actually talk about something that had to do with the reflected waves. And a couple of speakers during this symposium actually say that this is proven now beyond any doubt that slabs penetrate into the lower mantle. But I would like to put some doubt, or at least that they do it directly. And one of the experiments is something that actually Guy and Peter Scheer were first to use in terms of mapping topography of the upper mantle discontinuities, essentially the waves that are reflected from underside of the discontinuity. They're called SDS, in which case D, you can substitute 400 or 650 or 220 or 520, wherever you want to have discontinuity. As you can see, the paths near the source and the receiver are quite similar, but they differ here at the point, and the difference between the arrival time of the SDS phase, which will be precursor, because it will arrive before the big SS wave, is a function of the depth of the discontinuity as well as the laterally heterogeneous structure above the discontinuity. But as our models are improving, we are gaining more and more confidence that we can correct for laterally varying structure and therefore detect the actual discontinuity. The very high quality seismic data from global network, there's 20,000 dots, if you want to believe it or not. And each of them represents a single seismogram in which we observed SS wave. But then the precursors, which are much weaker, the reflection coefficient is only about 5%, are obtained by adding within some cap, usually of 10 degree radius, all the seismograms that are within that cap. And then you measure the difference in time between SDS and SS arrival. And in this way, correcting for laterally heterogeneous structure, you can obtain a topography of discontinuities. Now, the top pair, one is at 410, the other one is at 650, were obtained essentially by correcting our measurements for some existing Earth model. The scales are different, and in general, much larger topography is observed on 650 kilometers continuity than on 410. What we do now is, in the next sort of inversion, we invert for the velocity model and topography of discontinuities at the same time. And it removes certain trade-offs. As you can see, this picture now, this is simultaneous inversion for topography and velocities. But for example, this structure in the Pacific goes away. On the other hand, here, actually, the topography on 660 actually increases. So very clearly, by just correcting for known models is not the best thing to do. But notice that the topographies on these two discontinuities are decorrelated. There is not, you cannot think of it as the sort of image of the slab that perhaps penetrates or does penetrate through 400 and then 650 kilometer discontinuity. These are very large. This is several thousand kilometers across. So what this represents in a way, or at least that there are other data that very strongly speak in favor of it, is that this is accumulated slab material. Now the other example, the other figure here is of a different nature. This is now from inversion for 3D velocities, shear velocities, and in the particular parametrization, we allow the radial splines to be discontinuous at 670 km discontinuity. And the picture above the discontinuity and below are quite different. They're also very much different in their power spectrum. Now, why is this? It essentially means that the pattern of heterogeneity changes. And now if we look at cross sections, what happens is that you actually have a major change. You, for one thing, have a lot of accumulated fast material, presumably that's a slab material, and you don't see much below the discontinuity. There are some places that you actually see something, but again, it's not absolutely clear that this is a penetrating slab. For example, in one case of Tonga-Kermadec, the picture of higher velocities here could be actually, which Miyake thinks with her co-authors, that they caught a slab in the process of avalanche. That is, you have this collected material, and at some point, the negative buoyancy of it becomes large enough that it can break through the discontinuity. But certainly, these pictures don't tell us that slabs easily penetrate through the discontinuity. Yes? They are earthquakes. So here is the subduction zone, presumably. But you can see that this is another 30 degrees of the fast material, or 3,000 kilometers. So essentially, that's, I think, is the last slide, and I'm going to finish presently. But what this shows is that we really, at least in many cases, we cannot talk about a simple slab penetration. There is other evidence that indeed there is some communication between upper and lower mantle, but it's not necessarily in terms of slabs that essentially go easily through the discontinuity. That there is strong evidence. Now, the volume of this material is quite large compared to the, say, width of the slab or this segment of the slab. So this would indicate that this material can accumulate and remain in a transition zone for a very long time, at which point it might have opportunity to be at least partially reabsorbed in a upper mantle circulation, even if it eventually goes down. So I think that there is some evidence that there is some validity in both layered and whole mantle convection, but that perhaps it's a episodic exchange of the material rather than a simple and continuous penetration. Thank you very much. Any questions? I guess.
Do you see the anti-correlation on those
data? Well, not always. I guess on the top one, they both essentially the topography of discontinuities here are exaggerated by a factor of 4. It's sort of plus minus 20 kilometer on 650 discontinuity. So in this case, and the white line is where the discontinuity should be. So in this case, they both go a little bit. They both seem to be somewhat depressed. Here you see a large depression. Maybe you see a little bit of a depression here, but you here on the other hand you may see a little bit of the upward deformation because you see a little bit of a white here. But generally the topography in the 400 is much smaller than on 670. So at least my interpretation of this is that actually you have the stagnant slabs which accumulate there, and they eventually may break through, but it's not as simple as has been proposed by others.
I mean, it's better to say in these experiments that we don't really see the vicinity of the flat. I mean, development is very broad, so you see broad areas, and over those broad areas, it's certainly true that this part can look more a lot smaller than the 660. The big thing to stick out here is this depression under the Western Pacific, which the reasonable thing to say is that there is stagnating. So you're not seeing the classical picture of something going through and, you know, one going up and one going down. You're seeing some pond of some cold material pushing that whole region reaching down. So the classical model is getting better, so it's not what we observe at all. So, but it could be if you could. And there is some evidence from convergent phases in the vicinity of the class itself before falling into acceleration, but not from this kind of study. You can see that classical structure.
Yeah, in terms of the reflection and transmission coefficients, I didn't have any figures that would illustrate this, but there is some confusion in terms of generally measurements of amplitude are much more difficult than measurements of delay in phase or in travel time, partly because in addition to attenuation, they're also subject to focusing and defocusing by the elastic structure. But people have tried to measure amplitudes of waves reflected or converted at these two Mantoux discontinuities. And they are actually tend to be different than in most of the reference Earth models, both PREM as well as something YASP 91. You may remember more about it, but that's sort of one of the applications of you being Guy, I guess, because his nearly next door neighbor has done some study on this. But essentially, the velocity jumps tend to be smaller. A very strange thing happens. We see the SS reflections from 660 very strongly, but it's difficult to see PP reflections. And that's really not clear, because standard models would tend to say that the contrast of velocity is rather similar on both sides of the discontinuity. But what it might be, it may indicate a greater or different complexity for the shear velocities and compression of velocities in terms of the fine structure of the discontinuity, which in PREM is just shown as a single discontinuity. In reality, it may represent a series of steps. So there's still a lot of things to be clarified, and clearly things like this have implications, I think probably for all other three fields that are represented here, the mineral physics, geodynamics, as well as geochemistry. So, are there any other questions? I guess we have a 3:15 cookie break, but I'm happy. Yeah.
You mentioned the water on the moon as being the absence of water on the moon as being probably the primary reason you had so little attenuation.
Mm-hmm.
But couldn't just be, the moon's a lot colder, so the temperatures are going to be so much further from the melting point. Couldn't that be enough to give you such little attenuation?
Well, there are in some fairly old pieces, also perhaps 2 billion year old pieces of crust, say on a Canadian shield, and yet the attenuation there is much higher than on the moon. Yeah, but it's sort of factor of two. These are sort of logarithmic, these are exponential processes, so factor of two is not really as large as one would think of it in linear scale. But clearly the dynamics is different, but thinking about the crust, once you get deep inside the Earth, it's of course much hotter and all kinds of things. But these seismograms were relatively at short distances, so that the waves did not travel below the lithosphere. Yeah.
when you were talking about the SKS wave splitting,
mm-hmm.
Would the amount of splitting and the amount of splitting be used to estimate the length scale of the anisotropy?
Well, yes. Usually the modeling of these things is very simple. Also, it's non-unique because you don't know where along the path you encountered it. People tend to put it mostly somewhere in the lithosphere. But there are also other explanations. Barbara? About the interpretation of SKS. Pay attention. Why don't you repeat the question? I guess I will have her answer that.
Okay.